Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And welcome once again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, this is a continuation of the podcast that I did last week on Sacco and Vanzetti. If you haven't listened to that one and you want to be up to speed on this podcast, maybe go back and give it a listen and come back to us. Okay, you're back. Brilliant. Great. So, the previous podcast, we talked about the trial of Sacco and Vanzetti, two Italian anarchists who were, it was fairly likely falsely accused of murder and robbery and executed in 1927, largely because of the prejudices against anarchist thinking in America. Now, I drew a lot of what I was saying from the essay The Men and the Symbols by Eric Foner, written in 1977. And Eric Foner goes on in the essay to talk in great depth about the roots of anarchism in America. But let's, before we do that, talk about in very, very broad terms what anarchism actually is. The idea that underpins anarchism is a scepticism and a rejection of power itself, the structures of power, be that government, the accumulation of wealth in terms of capital, or what have you. There are many. The reason why I don't want to nail down anarchism, and I'm making this very broad and nebulous, is because the way in which different anarchisms manifest themselves, and there are umpteen different variants of anarchism, all hinge around the solution to that scepticism. Some anarchisms manifest themselves in a kind of hyper-individualism that actually is quite compatible with the extreme forms of capitalism we see in the 21st century. The very deeply mistrustful of states and bureaucracies, even though, irony of ironies, capitalism is absolutely dependent on state assistance and state intervention and state investment in innovation, where entrepreneurs, risk takers, who actually kind of risk avoiders, capital seeks to avoid risk as much as possible, won't tread, and therefore the state has to step in and do things. I don't want to go down too far down that route. Then there is a more leftist anarchism, an anarchism that's perhaps more compatible with Marxism, a communal or communitarian Marxism, anarchism that sees the ultimate society as being one similar to the Mir, the Russian peasant commune, where the society is self-governing and based on communitarian and shared values. So these are the kind of anarchism is inherently utopian in its outlook, and emerged in 19th century Europe from the observations of thinkers such as Bakunin and Kropotkin, who saw something inherently benign in peasant life in Russia and Poland. They obviously didn't look too hard, because peasant life in Russia and Poland was anything but. It was short and violent and alcoholic and misogynistic and distinctly not libertarian whatsoever. And the emergence of a kulak class in Poland, in Russia, in the 19th century would suggest that the Russian peasant has within his ranks innumerable capitalists. If anything, that kind of 19th century anarchism was a rejection of the dark satanic mills of the Industrial Revolution and an embrace of this kind of supposedly rural, bucolic, idyllic lifestyle, and that was viewed by the anarchists as being inherently less corrupted, more pure, more rarefied, more honest. And there was some inherently humanistic tradition of the collective that seemed to have passed through time. Whether people like Bakunin or Kropotkin knew this or not, the reality was that the Mir was not an ancient institution. The peasant collective was not age-old. It was a relatively modern thing, and it had been pioneered under the era of Catherine the Great by Potemkin and of the Potemkin village fame, and he had created the institutions of the Mir, of the collective, to enable a stable agricultural base in Russia, and this would allow a functioning society. And the view that many 19th century anarchists and also a kind of agrarian socialists in Russia had of this purer, more innocent and more politically valid way of living was inherently a romantic one. And you see the same romanticism in Western Europe as the Industrial Revolution develops and the idea exists in the eyes of many romantic poets that there is something that society has lost, something innocent, something rural, something special in nature that society has lost, and some kind of return to that would be ideal. Eric Foner points out that in America in the 19th century and the early 20th century, there were two anarchistic traditions. He says, the United States had two distinct anarchist traditions. Native anarchism, symbolised by Emerson and Thoreau, and deriving from the distrust of government, so pervasive in the writings of Paine and Jefferson, was a form of extreme individualism. It was often coupled with pacifism or non-violence, and usually coexisted with a commitment to private property as the bulwark of individual freedom. Immigrant anarchism, associated first with Germans, then Italians, was, in contrast, a form of libertarian communism. As Errico Malatesta, the great Italian anarchist, put it, anarchy without socialism is impossible. The first kind of anarchism, this sort of homestead anarchism, perhaps you could call it, which showed an immense mistrust of the state and the organs of state, is something that has existed throughout kind of the discourses of American history and political thought ever since the founding of America, right up until the present day. If the question of freedom is one which has kind of defined America, this nebulous notion of freedom, the state either is a threat to freedom, it inhibits freedom, or in the eyes of many, it is a device by which freedoms are protected. Sort of, it's, the state is either freedom from or freedom to. There are periods of 19th century American history where anarchism, or a kind of anarchy, an absence of the rule of the state, has been the norm or has been idealised. The expansion into the West, the colonisation of the Great Plains, essentially individuals, or so the myth-making goes, individuals colonised the Great Plains and the West before states emerged. Well, states kind of emerge in the terms of territories and then actual states alongside the expansion of individuals. But the fantasy that has existed within American political and cultural discourse is the fantasy of the frontier, where new civilizations were hewn from the soil, farms were settled, villages and towns were built, and the settlers did this without the help or the connivance or the interference of state power. In fact, it's only in this rather buccaneering view of American history that when the state intervenes, that problems inevitably emerge. American politicians have, particularly from the 60s onwards, I'm thinking about Barry Goldwater and then obviously Ronald Reagan, have hijacked this spirit of the frontier, this memory of the taming of the West, in order to show that government expenditure must be curbed, that government is the problem, that government can't offer solutions, and that once the pioneering spirit of everyday Americans is unbridled, is unleashed, then there will be tremendous transformations in America's fortunes. Unfortunately, in the case of both Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, these solutions were not based on a real understanding of America's economic difficulties or geopolitical difficulties in the 1960s, 70s or 80s. No amount of frontier spirit was going to change the fact that America was transitioning from being an economic surplus nation to a deficit nation, and that America's position from 1945 as a global net producer of goods and services was starting to be challenged and then overturned by competitors such as Germany and Japan, and therefore the transition from surplus to deficit meant that America had to cease being a manufacturer and instead become a banker of recycled euro and Japanese dollars. And the way in which to do that is to hike up interest rates, destroy native industry, create an attractive place for returns to be made on international finance, and essentially usher in neoliberalism, using, of course, the fantasy of the West to do it. If you're ever wondering why it is American presidents like to be seen wearing Stetsons, there is a very good reason why they do. The European anarchism that had come to the United States was of a very different variety. Eric Foner writes, "The millennial dream of Italian anarchism was a communal society in which the triad of old world evils, state, church and private property, had been abolished."
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
More than in any other country, anarchists in Italy exalted the propaganda of the deed. Terrorism, sabotage and assassination were all considered legitimate ways to stir the masses to revolutionary fervour. Now this concept, the propaganda of the deed, is quite a complex one. About 5 years ago, I did a podcast on Russian anarchists And the spate of assassinations in the Tsarist Russia of Alexander II and Alexander III. You can probably still find it. I'm sure it's still out there, but right at the very bottom of this archive. The belief, and it was a largely misguided one, that anarchists from the agrarian anarchists of the 19th century all the way up to the Red Brigades in Italy and Germany in the 1970s had, was that if they conducted a series of assassinations and bombings, then state repression of the working classes would ensue. The state would assume that trade unions and other working class organisations were at fault and that they needed to be crushed. And in this crushing, the masses would finally be roused, the scales would drop from their eyes, they would see the state for all the evil that it was, and rise up and overthrow it, and hey presto, you would have an anarchist utopia. Interestingly, this never happened. Instead, in most instances, when government ministers are assassinated, and when there are bombs thrown under the carriages of everyone from Napoleon III in France to the Kaiser in Germany and to the Tsars of Russia, most people react with horror. Working class people do not look at things by and large in simplistic political terms and think, well, there is a class war being waged and I am on the recipient of the boot of the upper classes. They simply, as most human beings do, look at arms and legs being blown off as being horrific and appalling. Now, the anarchists and their theorists did predict that there would be resistance amongst the working classes to propaganda through the deed, but they assumed that reaction would be the thing that would force the working classes into their arms. It's no coincidence that modern Islamist terror is modelled on 19th century anarchism in this way. The assumption of everyone from ISIS to Osama bin Laden was that there would be a wave of anti-Islam sentiment in the Western world following events such as 9/11 or the 7/7 bombings, and this would essentially show Muslim people living in the West that they have nowhere else to go and they should support Al-Qaeda or Islamic State or what have you. And again, a largely false premise that it doesn't matter how many terrorist attacks there have been. The vast majority of Muslims living in Western countries have not joined Islamic State or supported whatsoever. And you only need to look at the mass demonstrations against Islamic State that have happened, not just in Britain and America by Western Muslim people, but also in Iraq itself. So there you go. But in Marx's writings, there was very little that anticipated the existence of a working class that was actually loyal to the organs of state or loyal to the institutions of state. Marx again assumed that over a long period of time, the working classes would understand their oppression, would form the political parties and institutions, trade unions, revolutionary organisations that would overthrow capitalism and hey presto. He thought that it would take probably a lot longer than practitioners such as Lenin and Trotsky imagined. And Marx also thought that there were certain countries, such as Russia, for example, where it was important not to try socialism for a very long time. Instead, it would have to wait till Antonio Gramsci in the 1930s to really explain why it was that working class people didn't flock to the banner of the revolution, and he suggested there was such a thing as hegemony. He argued that hegemony are the ideas that the ruling classes inculcate on the poor, and he said that in democratic societies, and in fact in most societies, It's impossible to rule through coercion alone. You can't simply just batter the poor into submission. There are too many of them. So what you have to do is incorporate them ideologically into the system, into the hierarchy of capitalism, or feudalism perhaps, by making them believe that their interests were aligned with the interests of the ruling class, and that they were in some way benefiting from the selling of their surplus labour value, the classic Marxist theory of labour exploitation. And Gramsci argued that with the modern mass media, this had been incredibly successful. So much so that real hegemony, a real hegemonic idea, is almost completely invisible. It's simply taken as common sense, the idea that capitalism and private property are the optimal ways of running society. For most people in capitalist societies, this is a complete and utter unchallengeable given. Such is the idea also that there is, you know, a kind of a natural order to things, that class is inevitable, that private wealth is always earned and deserved. It's these ideas that Gramsci said really were the real glue that held capitalist society together. And it was these kinds of ideas that meant that the Italian anarchists that landed on American soil began to bring about their propaganda of the deed were going to be unsuccessful. Eric Foner writes, although anarchists comprised only a small part of the Italian left before World War I, through emigration they exerted a powerful influence on the anarchist movement abroad. Among the most important exponents of Italian anarchism was Luigi Galliani, the man Vanzetti acknowledges as our master. A brilliant propagandist and polemicist, Galliani preached a stern brand of anarcho-communism, rejecting any form of political organisation and advocating violent revolution and relentless war against capitalism. In his newspaper, Cronaca Sovversiva, Galliani lionised President McKinley's assassin, Zagolj, as well as Gattiano Bresci, who had returned from Paterson, New Jersey, to assassinate King Umberto of Italy. During World War I, the federal government suppressed Galliani's newspaper when it urged Italians to resist the draft. Galliani himself was deported in May 1919, but not before he had called on his followers for violent revenge. Soon afterward, bombs exploded in 8 cities, and an Italian was killed trying to place a bomb at Attorney General Palmer's Washington home. And it was this bombing campaign that initiated the Palmer raids, which saw anarchists and socialists arrested across America. Ironically for Galliani, the champion of the working classes, it was Attorney General Palmer's maid who opened the bomb which blew her hands off. Now, it's known that in the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, there was a huge degree of media interest in the case, and there was a huge degree of political activism surrounding Sacco and Vanzetti. In Boston, writers and intellectuals campaigned to save them both from the electric chair. The alumni of the American liberal left, John Dewey, Dorothy Parker, John Dos Passos, publicly protested against the sentence, hope that the men would be found innocent, but also hoping that at least the sentence could be commuted to a life sentence. However, as often happens in these cases, the intellectual class overestimated its importance and underestimated the extent to which it is resented by the rest of society. The writer Granville Hicks wrote at the time, "The battle was between the intellectuals and everybody else. The guilt of Sacco and Vanzetti having been firmly established in the minds of the general public meant that the intellectual support for Sacco and Vanzetti clashed with another tradition in American culture, that of anti-elitism, the idea that ivory tower intellectuals were simply speaking down to the morality of the ordinary American and for some inexplicable reason were wanting to spare these dangerous foreign terrorist types from the justice that America had lined up for them. In fact, most of the money that was raised to defend Sacco and Vanzetti, $300,000, came from the Italian-American community, from small donations, and within the Italian-American community, because of the advent of fascism in Italy 5 years earlier, there was already a well-developed anti-fascist politics. For example, one of the donors was the Lega Antifascista of Pittsburgh. And in the eyes of many Italian-Americans, the spectre of anti-Italian racism was there in the case of Sacco and Vanzetti. The assumption in the eyes of many Italian-Americans, and it's probably a perfectly valid one, was that the view of Italians were that they were essentially knife-wielding Sicilian criminals who vowed omerta, the vow of silence, and worked for some kind of criminal backer. Or they were senseless political extremists who believed in ideas that are incompatible with being American. Whereas the reality is that Sacco and Vanzetti were poor immigrants who were easily exploitable and exploited initially for their labour, but then finally exploited for their judicial and political reasons and put to death because of their politics in a period of anti-communist, anti-socialist and anti-anarchist hysteria. Anyway, I hope you found that useful, and do remember, if you can, to give us a good write-up on the Explaining History iTunes page, and if you can support us on Patreon, that would be grand as well. Many thanks, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.